when you come across corruption, there's people benefiting from that corruption. There's a lot of people benefiting. And when you go to challenge it and expose it, those people come out of the woodwork and try to destroy you. So that's what you have to be prepared for.
Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, board-certified health and wellness coach and founder of Avantia Health Optimization. Today, we're speaking with the founder and former CEO of Overstock.com, Patrick Byrne, who was a pleasure to speak with, really cool guy. I actually connected with him through General Michael Flynn, who is somebody I really admire. So I'm grateful to have gotten the chance to speak with Patrick Byrne. I will warn you about this episode in particular is perhaps a little more political in nature than we usually do on this show. I really try to avoid politics as much as I can. It's just been tougher lately because everything has become politicized. Now, Patrick Byrne was involved in a new movie docuseries called The Enemy Within, and that's really where things get political with this episode in particular, because he was working with the FBI. He made efforts to expose corruption, and there's really a lot to that. So I suggest that you check out the movie, The Enemy Within. You can find the link for that in the show notes. But of course, if I'm talking to the founder and former CEO of Overstock.com, I got to ask some questions beyond the politics. And that's where we start. I ask him everything from questions about his photographic memory to Bitcoin, which is really exploding in popularity. As usual, I have a question about propaganda, which I seem to hit in almost every episode. There's questions about stress and his involvement with the FBI, some of the details in the movie, artificial intelligence. I even ask him about the deep state, which is maybe the most political question I ask him. So there's a ton of good stuff. And let me tell you a little bit more about Patrick Byrne himself. It's actually Dr. Patrick Byrne, because he holds a PhD in philosophy from Stanford University. He's an advocate for blockchain technology and cryptocurrency, which is why I asked him about Bitcoin. He actually resigned from Overstock.com in 2019 after disclosing a relationship with Russian agent Maria Butina, which is a central theme in the movie I discussed earlier, The Enemy Within. He's the son of John J. Byrne, who's the former chairman of Geico. Actually, he's an author and a speaker on all kinds of issues. He's known for his libertarian views and challenging conventional business practices. So overall, a really cool guy to speak with. And I think you're going to love this episode. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Patrick Byrne. One thing that really intrigued me at the very beginning of the movie is you have this photographic memory. And I'm big on cognition. I have a background in cognitive psychology. You can memorize a full deck of cards. You said you can memorize a 2-hour conversation and write 30 pages describing every word. Yeah, I mean, you've done a lot of like covert work too, and you worked in Overstock. You founded Overstock CEO. So what are some of the other cool or interesting ways that that photographic memory has served you?
Well, I think the word is eidetic. I'm able to only if I focus on something intently. Otherwise, I'm an absent-minded professor. I can get lost in a shoebox. But I can focus on things and memorize them if I focus intently. I play different games with it all the time. I was sick for many years and in the hospital, I amused myself rehearsing it. But actually, the truth is that probably poetry, when I was a child, I had a lot of speech impediments. I said wabbit and I lisped and I stuttered and I said totanut. And my mother would, my mother learned that I could memorize poetry and recite it without all that stuff. So she carried a book of poems around. And then I would also, in my childhood, learn poems for people rather than giving them physical presents. From when it came up by my dad's birthday, I'd have memorized Casey at the Bat, or I'd memorized the Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven. I memorized all this poetry. And then when I was sick for years in the hospital, I sort of summoned all those back up. So I know a lot of poetry by heart.
Is it ever a curse?
Yeah, well, some people who have dated me would say it is because it's just a mistake to lie to me. Because if a gal told me something one time and then two and a half years later she tells me something and there's some little detail is different, I'll know, oh, she lied to me. And that's cost a couple of relationships.
Oh, man. So it's a double-edged sword there.
It's a double-edged sword.
Well, so you have this, what seems to be a natural gift, but are there any ways you can think of that other people can try to sharpen their minds? Anything that you've done for that?
Absolutely. It's really a matter of use it or lose it. I used to work for kind of the father of cognitive psychology, George Miller at Princeton. And absolutely. It's a matter of as a child, I was always memorizing and playing these mental games. And I just discovered if you use it, it's like a muscle. It grows and grows and grows. And so to me, it was something that I built more than just something that I was born with as a fluke.
Do you ever notice a change in that ability? And just to kind of set the scene on that, I've been doing the carnivore diet lately, and I've noticed that I feel a lot sharper, like crazy sharp. I wake up almost like I had a cup of coffee already. And actually, just last night, I ate some Indian food, so some bread, some rice. I don't feel as sharp as I did just yesterday. Do you notice things like that when you change your diet or anything?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Comfort food makes you sleepy and groggy, and carnivore food makes you sharp as a knife. It is true. Good. I've noticed exactly the same thing.
Interesting. Okay.
I'm missing a gallbladder, which means I'm supposed to eat. Without a gallbladder, you can only digest about 20% as much meat as before. And so I ended up, carbs became part of my big, much bigger part of my life than they were. And I recently discovered that actually things have somewhat returned because I have a stump of a gallbladder, and that stump does enough of the work. So I started eating more meat, and yeah, I noticed exactly the same thing. We're clearly built to eat protein and meat and with, you know, a smattering of greens and less comfort food. I just stay away from comfort food now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I've spoken with a lot of medical doctors on this subject, and you know, there's a lot of conflicting opinions out there, but my own experience is similar to yours. So it's neat to hear.
And also alcohol. Alcohol is at the correct way, in my view, the correct way to grow old is to not have a drop of alcohol, not one drink. And I wish I'll observe that for months at a time. And then when I'm with other people, and I'm going to nice restaurants and everyone's having a glass of wine, I have a glass of wine. And yeah, I totally feel it. And certainly if I have two drinks, I will so feel it the next day. And it totally takes the edge off you.
Yeah, I agree. I'm the same way. I'm not a big fan of alcohol because it slows me down. And yeah, it's not very healthy either. But you also, between everything you've done, I mean, you know, running overstock.com and working with the FBI and a lot of the stressful things that you see in the movie, The Enemy Within, this docuseries, which I highly recommend people see. How do you deal with this stress?
Well, I do a lot of meditation, and there was a period for about 5 years in the last decade or 6 years, I was doing a lot of yoga, and yoga was great. At one point, I was going through a lot of illness, and I smoked pot. I have to say, looking back, that takes smoking pot too much or too consistently, I think, takes the edge off too. But I don't actually really feel the stress so much anymore. I just don't feel it. I think maybe I've lived in such a stressful environment for so long that at some point it becomes, you don't even feel it. It's just life.
Well, then let's rewind a little bit. Let's go back to some of the most, whatever you might identify as a very stressful period. You mentioned meditation. Maybe that was part of the picture. What are maybe some of the other things that helped you get through that?
Walking. I think that we evolved walking on the veld in Africa for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And walking is very natural. That's why babies, if they're crying, just rocking them puts them to sleep because it mimics the feeling of being carried on the veld. And I think that's our natural state. And we're really supposed to walk 10 miles a day. There have been times I've been a big walker, and it's instead of going driving across town to see a movie, I walk 4 miles to see a movie and then I walk home. And if you live like that, in fact, I've made it for much of my life after I had cancer. I made it my system that I always found a place to live that was about 2 miles away from wherever I worked. And so I would just, and if you live a mile or two away from where you work, you end up saying to yourself, you know, it's going to take me 30 minutes to walk it. By the time I get in the car and get out of the garage and drive and hit all the lights and this and that, and then find a place to park and then go in, it's going to take me 15 or 20 minutes. Might as well take the extra 10 minutes and get my 2 mile walk in. And then you do it again at home and you do. And so it just really gets you used to walking 3 or 4 miles a day. If all you do is walk 3 or 4 miles a day, that's a very big deal. I guess for those who can afford it, the best $30,000 I ever spent in my life, best $30,000 I ever spent in my life by far was what something called an endless pool, which is a pool that's like a treadmill. It's only about 12 feet long and it creates a current that you swim against. And so for about 10, 12 years, wherever I lived, I always had that with me and I kept it a few feet outside my bedroom door, my bedroom window. And so I could get up in the morning, and I would keep it real warm. And you don't want to get out of bed and you want to sleep in, but if you say, there's nice warm water waiting for me and I can just take 10 steps and be in it. And you get in it and I swim 1 mile, 30 minutes, 1 mile. And I learned that if all I do every day is I swim 30 minutes, which is 30, 35 minutes is a mile for me, you'd be in about 6 weeks, you just become hard like woodpecker lips. And then I put a chinning bar up over it, but something I could sort of jump up and grab. And that way I could hang and do pull-ups in the water, but with some of the weight supported and doing a lot of chin-ups. And I was 50 years old when I started doing that, and I turned back into a beast in my 50s. Was from doing that. A mile swim every day with some chin-ups and pull-ups and different things. And in 6 weeks, that's all it really took. And what I don't want to do is ever get in a weight room again. I spent years of my life, my teenage years, and I was a college football player. And I spent so much of my youth lugging iron that to me, the idea of going into a gym and lugging iron is the last thing in the world I want to do.
Interesting. That's pretty neat. So you do anybody can meditate. Anybody can go on a walk. You know, anybody can really go swimming. There's local YMCA. There's places people can go for sure. I'll have to add that. What'd you call it? The treadmill pool?
Endless pool.
I'm going to have to get one of those. I'll add that to my Christmas list.
Well, that 30 grand, I got more out of that $30,000 than thousands of hours. And to me, if I have to drive somewhere to go work out, and if I have to drive somewhere, you just find all these reasons to skip it. But if it's 10 feet outside your house and you can get up in the morning and know that you're going to be hopping some nice, pleasant water, you don't end up avoiding it.
I ask you these sorts of questions because, I mentioned I'm a board-certified health coach. The show is Healthy and Awake Podcast. So we do talk both about health and some of the awake stuff, which is why I think you're a perfect guest, because your docuseries that you're in very much along the lines of some of this awake stuff. And I do want to get into that. Kind of transitioning towards that, you obviously have a lot of experience in business. Marketing is a big component of that. You look at the landscape of the world we're in today, propaganda is everywhere. And so I'm wondering your thoughts on the landscape that we're in between the marketing, the propaganda. A lot of people don't know what's true, what's not true, what to think, who to trust. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's funny. I've never met anyone else who uses the word awake like I think you're using it. And how I use it is I say to my 5, 6 years ago, I would say to my woke friends who were trying to get me to be woke, I would tell them, look, I'm not woke, but I never slept. I am awake. I've always been awake. You have to understand how corrupt things have gotten. You know, our founding fathers in Federalist Number 10, Madison wrote that the thing that brings down republics more than anything else is corruption. And just being aware of how much we set up government regulators and government entities to protect us, our society, from different industries. But you have to be awake to the possibility that those institutions actually get captured and turned against us. And that's, I think, we're living in a day where the regulators got captured, the senators, the congressmen, the newspapers, the professors, everyone got captured. If you're in health, you have to see how the health industry, which is regulated by the FDA and the CDC, you know, they've become, they're terribly captured. It's clear that they're not making good decisions on behalf of us. They're making decisions based on who they hope to hire them, you know, after they've done their 10 or 15 years at their regulator. So I would assume that if you're awake, you understand that, which means that you have to check out from the conventional wisdom or be open to, you know, when I was a kid, I bought that people were kooky who didn't buy what the AMA told them. Now I've got serious doubts about everything that comes out of big pharma, because if something isn't profitable to them, I think it's clearly the case that a lot of the decision-making gets driven by their profits rather than what's really best for us.
And some of the most egregious propaganda out there is pharmaceutical propaganda. And I don't even necessarily mean targeted at the people. I mean, the doctors are absolutely the target of propaganda. But I guess on a separate note, I know you're big on blockchain technology. You talk a lot about AI. I heard you actually claim on another podcast that you played a central role, if not the central role, in the development of CBDC, central bank digital currency type technology. So
if you Google my name in Barbados, you'll see that I created the first CBDC maybe 7 years ago in Barbados, myself and a friend named Gabriel Abed in Barbados and 7 or 8 Eastern Caribbean Union countries. We created the world's first CBDC back then. Now, it was architected so as to enhance liberty. And I very much was afraid that the Chinese would catch up doing it their way, which was authoritarian. But my way was a liberty enhancing. And it's not too late. It's not too late for us to, you know, the Chinese have taken it much more seriously. And Xi Jinping came out not long after I was doing things and said, this is one of the 5 most important technologies China must dominate. And then they came out a year later and Xi Jinping said, this isn't one of the 5. This is the most important technology for us to dominate in the future. Is blockchain.
Bitcoin's almost at 100K. Is it too late to get into that, you think?
It was a million. The real question, how high can Bitcoin go, should be rephrased as how low can the dollar go? And the dollar can go a lot lower. The dollar can go, it's like, imagine being in the Weimar Republic and somebody saying, how much can a loaf of bread cost anyway? They didn't quite conceive that at some point a loaf of bread could cost 40 quadrillion marks or whatever it was. And given that we have destroyed our dollar through financial mismanagement, I eventually think it's going to collapse. It could be right around the corner. And we might give some thought to what we're there. There's ways to save it in a way that minimizes human suffering. And I hope that Trump brings in the right people who understand this.
One of my biggest regrets in life, when I was maybe 16, 17, 18, I worked at a pizza place making pizza, and this scruffy guy used to come in and tell me, you got to get in on Bitcoin. It's like probably $1 at that time. You got to get in every time you come in, almost every day. You got to get Bitcoin. Didn't listen to him. And I would have been rolling in it if I had just listened to that guy. He's probably got a couple of Bugattis by now. But I even saw, actually just today, Georgia used blockchain technology to secure voting. That was just breaking news I saw before we hopped on.
Country of Georgia or the state?
State.
It will surprise me if they follow through with that, because I think that the Raffensperger, I think the Secretary of State and Governor there are corrupt, and that they're not going to want a true system. But God bless them if they do. That was one of the technologies. I picked 5 technologies that I thought were fundamental to civilization and said, I want to invest in these and get them going. There were blockchain land titling, blockchain central banking, blockchain Wall Street, blockchain supply chains, and then blockchain voting. And I funded the earliest companies in the world in those areas, got them going.
But I know you've been a big advocate of blockchain. I've been a little skeptical about it from the beginning, which is why I got into it so late. So I guess I'm wondering what makes you so confident that it is as good as you say.
Blockchain is based on the mathematics that underlies cryptography. And it's an area of mathematics called computation theory that I used to study at Stanford. And what we've learned is powerful interests, the oligarchs, they can capture everything in society. They can capture regulators, they can capture senators and congressmen, they capture newspapers, they capture academia, they can, but even Goldman Sachs cannot cheat the laws of mathematics. So by rebuilding all these social institutions within the laws of math with cryptography that is built on the laws of mathematics, it means that the powerful people can't cheat mathematics. No matter how rich you are, you can't cheat mathematics.
Now, pardon my ignorance here with this follow-up question, just because I don't understand this as well as you do, but you know, I do see people online who do feed into the reasons to be skeptical, saying things like, you know, BlackRock is getting involved in Bitcoin and they're going to try to do something to really throw a wrench in the whole thing. And there are other examples too, but I mean, if it's as secure as you're saying it is now, I mean, are there still other things that maybe they can do to try to disrupt this?
Great question. My real allegiance, while I've owned a lot of Bitcoin, my real allegiance is not Bitcoin, it's blockchain. It's the underlying technology called blockchain. But yeah, I do worry that Bitcoin has some things that could disrupt it. For example, in the way Bitcoin works, people generally know it, but at this point, there are miners, different machines people set up to mine around the world. And the mining, whatever 51% of mining power agrees is the truth, is then the truth. And about who owns what coins, which wallet owns which coins. And why that is a problem is China. China has officially, last I checked, it was about 40% of the mining power. And so still under 50, but they also, there's a bunch of Chinese-made machines out there around the world doing mining. And there are all these different countries, but it turns out that Antminer, being the dominant one, had a back end in it that anytime they wanted to, they could activate and control from China. That means that Xi Jinping could wake up someday and say, I've decided that all the Bitcoin in the world is owned by my daughter, and he could do it. And if 80%, I mean, he might really control 80% if you include not just what they control in China, but all these machines. Now, that particular backdoor in Antminer was fixed, but I'm afraid that there are, now, even if he did that, there would be ways to defeat it. People would just say, no, that was cheating, and they would create a fork of Bitcoin that didn't recognize it. But I do worry about Bitcoin having a flaw like that. There's one that I had a co-hand in inventing called Ravencoin, which is really, so there's Bitcoin 1.0 is Bitcoin. Bitcoin 2.0 is Ethereum. There's Bitcoin 3.0, that's Ravencoin. And it's a fork of blockchain, but built so you could handle securities and contracts. And Ravencoin, which is only 2 or 3 cents, it's like the early days of Bitcoin, that may be the big winner at the end of the day.
You've tried the apps, you've signed up for gym memberships, and you've given it your all, yet you're still not where you want to be. What's missing? Accountability and expert guidance. As a board-certified health and wellness coach, I provide the personalized support that you need to finally make real, lasting progress. Making a solid health routine last and stay consistent is hard work, but you don't have to do it alone. Let's work together to turn your health goals into reality. Are you ready to transform? Start your journey at Avantia Health Optimization by clicking the link in the show notes or by going to mikevera.com, where you can try your first session for just $1. Now back to the show.
If you want to rebuild society on this new fabric, you know, it's a little bit like talking to somebody. Imagine you go back in time to 1970, before there were databases, and you were sitting there telling to somebody, there's this thing coming along called a database, and it's going to change the whole way the world works. And they're like, well, what's so special about it? What's it? It's like, God, how do you even begin to explain how much it's going to change things once there are databases, and you're not going to have people whose whole job is filing pieces of paper and all this kind of stuff? It's going to change the world. And they're like, well, what exactly? Well, it's kind of hard to even get your mind around how much databases are going to change the way everything works.
Yeah.
Well, that's what blockchain is. It's something that's so deep and vast that it's hard to even put into words how much it's going to change. But the short way of saying it is a lot of human activity and a lot of human institutions really amount to strangers. If we just meet, we can't trust each other. If I may tell you that I own this piece of land and you want to buy this piece of land, and I can give you a piece of paper that says, okay, now you own it, but you don't know if you can trust me. So humans create this third institution called the Land Titling Office. And we all just agree to trust it. And what it says the truth is about who owns this piece of land, we all agree is the truth. And that solves that problem for us. Well, you can apply that same logic. You can see a lot of institutions the same way. Visa cards are the same way. I go into a restaurant, I eat. He doesn't know if I promise to pay in a month, if I'm going to pay or not. But if we all agree, there's this thing called a Visa card, and I trust it I can send it my money, and you, the restaurant owner, trust it. You know, you can say the same thing of all kinds of. I was once in an office in Silicon Valley looking at a wall of what they'd come up with about 150 institutions of society that really, that's fundamentally, that's what they all have in common. You can now do that. You can do that instead of having a government institution or private institution doing it. You can do it on this technology called blockchain. And there's nothing that anyone has to worry about trusting, because it's all built mathematically and transparently in a way that nobody has to worry about whether it can be trusted or not. So that's what I would say. What that means, though, is over the last several thousand years, humans have accumulated a lot of institutions to perform these tasks, which we can now do without the institutions. We can do with this new technology. And one thing we've learned is those institutions get captured and by people who cheat, and they create loopholes and all kinds of things, like the stock market. And there's all kinds of mischief in the stock market. You can recreate the stock market within blockchain, and suddenly there's no way, all kinds of mischief that goes on Wall Street now, you can't even do in that kind of a stock market. So anyway, that's why I think it's so civilizational. It disrupts thousands of years of the way we've done certain things.
Wow. Yeah, now I have a million more questions, but we have other questions to get to. So I'm going to have to do some more research on that. Now, your movie, The Enemy Within, one of the central parts of that is that you were a whistleblower. So what did you blow the whistle on?
Well, whistleblower isn't quite the right word. Informant isn't. Okay. Right word. What I explain is that I've actually had this lifelong relationship to Uncle Sam, and I'm not a spy. I've never worked for the CIA, but I had this long, since I was really in college, is the first time something happened, that I've had this lifelong relationship with Uncle Sam. Most of it has been academically oriented, or it's often had to do with issues involving peace. And there were times that I had an opportunity and someone tapped me on the shoulder to perform some little task that generally had to do with peace and moving the ball of the ox cart of peace an inch forward. And it really was the honor of my life. So I've never been married, never had a family. I've always, to be honest, I've lived in kind of a 40-year end of life situation. I had cancer right as I got out of college. I had cancer three times. And when that happens, you don't really think in terms of settling down and having a family, because I never knew, figured I'd be around more than another 2 or 3 years. So it was always the honor of my life that on occasion I got asked to do certain things that helped our country, and generally they were about peace. In 2010, President Obama promoted me, or 2011, to something called a national intelligence asset. Again, I emphasize, it's intelligence in a different, I'm not a spook, I don't spy on people, I'm not CIA. But I've worked for a lot of other agencies and the National Security Council, generally on things that had that a lot of times it was just academic. Things I'd talked or written about publicly, I'd be asked to come into some government setting in Quantico or something. And there's 100 people from around the government in a room. I come in, I give my PowerPoint, and they usher me out, and that's the last I hear of it. And it's been very flattering that people wanted, that people in government thought and, you know, gave me those invitations. And it was really the honor of my life. But, and I thought it would all die with me. I never thought it would come out. But in 2015, 2016, I got drawn into certain things and I saw them from the inside and I became aware of what's in effect a soft coup to take over our country. And that was the starting off with the Russian collusion hoax and the Hillary Clinton. I was part of the Hillary Clinton investigation. And I can tell you that I walked in 2019 to the DOJ and just came out and told them everything really going on. 10 days later, they announced the Durham Commission. So that was predicated on my information. But then I waited. They kept me quiet for 4 years as they told me they were investigating this. And then when they finally came out with their report, it's a cover-up. The report is true, but it only tells half the story. It tells what happened from July 2016 on, and there's a huge cover-up about what happened from July 2015 to July 2016. There was a huge cover-up. And so it was sort of once the Durham report came out, I decided I had lived within the boundaries of as much as I could possibly. My country was burning. It was time I just came out and told my country the story. And I did a long magazine interview, which then turned into a book called Danger Close. And then General Michael Flynn took the book. And this year he spent 10 months and he turned it into a movie called, you can get to by patrickburnmovie.com, but the movie's called Enemy Within docuseries.com. If you type that, you'll get it. It's up on Rumble and it's coming up on and Movie X, and it's coming up on major platforms in another week or two.
And we'll put the links to the show notes down below, as well as a coupon code for anyone who wants to check that out. And I'll tell you, we actually don't talk a lot about politics on this show. So this is a unique episode for us here. But I do think it's important for people to hear this sort of stuff because the TV only presents one side. It's one single narrative. I think that's how people can often get misled. And so, you know, people think for themselves. Don't take anything that's said here from myself or yourself at face value. I encourage people to critically think and examine things for themselves. And you know, part of what you're talking about and part of even some of the controversy you've been involved in is around this idea of the deep state. And I was talking with someone yesterday saying, you know, oh, we were talking about this interview coming up. I mentioned the deep state and she said, what is that? So I want to ask you, what is the deep state?
Isn't that, to me, that's bizarre that somebody at this point doesn't know or would deny or even not know what the deep state is.
I agree. What if simply mastering your breath could unlock greater mental clarity, stress resilience, and physical control? Created by Erwan LaCour, who has been on the show twice, breath hold work is a powerful meditation practice designed to push the limits of your body and mind. This transformative approach has elevated my own mindful practice and helped many of my clients achieve deeper focus and stress relief. Breathhold Work offers online courses and live programs to guide you through this empowering journey, no matter your experience level. Ready to tap into your full potential? Check out Breathhold Work through the link in the show notes. By supporting them, you're also helping the podcast continue to deliver great guests and life-changing content. So please check out the link below. Hey, do you spend a lot of time looking at screens like your phone, the TV, the computer? Well, that can actually lead to some pretty severe disruption in your circadian rhythm, which messes with your sleep, your hormones, your energy, your mood, your clear-headedness. It can actually disrupt quite a bit. Well, Boncharge has life-changing solutions to enhance your well-being and prevent some of those issues. Their blue light blocking glasses, which I'm actually wearing right now, have honestly transformed my life and even the lives of many of the people I work with. I regularly hear how quickly people's sleep improves once they start using these glasses at night. Plus, their red light therapy devices and other wellness products offer cutting-edge health benefits. With the holiday season just around the corner, it's the perfect time to invest in your health or give the gift of wellness to someone special. Right now, there's actually huge discounts during their biggest sale of the year. So click the link in the show notes to shop and support the show, because every purchase helps me keep bringing you great guests and impactful content. Now back to the show.
And I know you're telling the truth, but isn't it a little hard to conceive?
It is.
Well, the best way to explain it is actually with regard to Turkey, because that's where the expression was invented. Ataturk, when he created modern Turkey, put in place a bunch of, you know, a constitutional structure, but he also created a, within the government, well, within the country, there were a group of people who had a secret mission, and the mission was to prevent any Islamist from becoming president and turning the country into a theocracy. And so there were judges and generals and newspaper editors and police chiefs and university people whose whole mission, not whole mission, but they always in the background, their job was if any sort of Islamic demagogue started rising, to destroy them. They didn't get published. They didn't get printed. They ended up in jail, things like that. And it worked for Turkey for about 100 years. And then Erdogan is the first to break it. But it's a state within the state that has its own mission and purpose. In our country, it's not so benign. There's a deep corrupt level within the government. And they're very much against the Constitution. They're very much against our constitutional republic. And they had their own agenda. And their agenda really turns out, we've seen it in the last 4 years, it's been, which I view as an attempted overthrow of the American Republic. And they seem to want some kind of, a lot of them are what we see as, from our political paradigm, as lefty. From a philosophical paradigm, they're Hegelian or Trotsky. They're neo-Trotskyites. They think that the world would be better off if there were sort of one central global government that ran things, and the nation state itself, which has only been around 350 years, that the nation state itself as a mechanism would dissolve and there'd just be sort of one central government. Of course, what's wrong with that is if you don't like your government, where do you move? You know, it's the idea that someone could believe that and not understand it's going to become authoritarian in a split second is silly. And yet we have all these sort of left-wing college professors who've bought into this, not knowing or not caring that is the surest recipe you could have of humanity living under authoritarianism would be that.
So when I think of the deep state, you know, specific people, the two that come to top of mind are people like Bill Gates, Klaus Schwab, and of course, you know, some of the politicians we know as well. But that's where things get tricky, because people closely tie their identity to politicians. Trump, for instance, a lot of people say he's part of this deep state secretly, he's controlled opposition, or it's all just a big show to make people think that things are going to get better and they're going to get solved. But, you know, secretly he's part of the deep state or something like that. So what are your thoughts there?
I could go on all day about things that I wish President Trump had done differently or acted differently or said different things. But I can promise you one thing he's not is deep state. If he was deep state, he wouldn't be dodging bullets there in Butler, Pennsylvania. No, he's not deep state. The deep level of corruption really came in with John Brennan. And I hate to say it because I used to. So I never voted for, I did not vote for Trump either the first two times. I've always voted, I'm very centrist, libertarian, small L libertarian, not capital L libertarian, but it's really Comey, Brennan, and Obama. They tried to overthrow our government, and I was part of it. I was part of it. They had me on the orders of Brennan, on the orders of James Comey, they had me set up Hillary Clinton for a bribe. And I successfully set up Hillary Clinton for a bribe for what I thought was normal law enforcement work. And in fact, it was used to blackmail her instead. And it was going to be used to blackmail her for her 8 years of presidency. So that's when I started realizing that I was working for some people who were trying to overthrow the constitutional plans. And that was Comey, Brennan, and it turns out Barack Obama. Which I'm sorry to say, I worked for the guy. I risked my life on several occasions for on his instructions, but it turns out that they were a bunch of bad guys.
So do you see the end of the deep state near?
Well, the only chance we had for it was Donald Trump being elected. And then it comes in is now he's surrounded by a bunch of people that if he's got to not make the same mistakes he made last time. And that was he surrounded himself. First of all, you know, in 3 weeks into his presidency, he let them take out Mike Flynn. Mike Flynn understood the deep state. I think Trump's goose was cooked the moment he let them take out Mike Flynn. Because when that happened, there was, you know, Trump had never spent a night in Washington, D.C. before. He didn't know Washington. He's a New York realtor and television, and he knows a lot of business. But he didn't understand D.C. And Mike Flynn is that's his jungle. And when he had Mike Flynn by his elbow, it made him enormously effective. Once they took out, the deep state took out Mike Flynn, and once they took out Mike Flynn, Trump was kind of a sitting duck, and he spent the next 4 years just trying to keep his head above water. So he's got to, and I see some worrying signs that, well, some of his picks I like very much. I love Tulsi Gabbard, and I like RFK. You're good with RFK?
He's the man.
But I'm afraid he's reaching, I think dear President Trump is overly dazzled by celebrity and wealth. So for him to reach in Oz again, Oz betrayed him so badly. Oz, and you know, Oz in the, his competitor for the in the primary was a woman named Kathy Barnett. Kathy is, I think, could be vice presidential candidate. She's wonderful. Do you know Kathy Barnett, who that is?
I don't.
It's an African-American woman from Pennsylvania. She's like, there's a philosopher I much admire named Thomas Sowell. And it's like, yeah. This is like Thomas Sowell in heels. She's so strong and powerful and well-spoken and just, she's wonderful. She should be a presidential candidate. And Trump had his choice between Oz and her. And he ended up endorsing Oz. And Oz, you know, rode Trump all through the primaries. And the moment he won the primaries, he scrubbed from his website all mention of Trump and never mentioned him again. So he's not really committed to any MAGA principles or any America First principles. That was just, so here's, Trump has made him, or he's considering making him, the head of his HHS. Trump doesn't hold a grudge. And I guess that's generally a good trait in somebody, but I wish he remembered when people had betrayed him and he remembered a lot. And he can't have those kinds of people around him. You know, personnel is policy, they say in D.C. If he starts having a bunch of establishment wankers fill up his cabinet, then you're going to get just more swamp. I wish he would fill his entire cabinet with people who are former military officers, because at least, especially from the Marines and the Army special or the special operations community, because, and a lot of them have gone on, gotten advanced degrees. They're economists. They're this, that. They're just fine intellectually. And most importantly, what I've learned is if somebody has spent 6 years of their life crawling around in the mud or something, you know they're not just a careerist. They're not just an opportunist. They care about the country. And that's the first test. That's the litmus test. That should be. And then after that, find the ones who've gone to Wall Street and understand capital markets or economics or health or something. But we would be better off if he had a bunch of people who were maybe, you know, B plus at Wall Street, but had that kind of a background, than to have people who were A plus from Wall Street, but they were all from the same East Coast, community, that, you know, elitist community. That's not where he should be hiring, in my view. Not that he asks me.
Yeah, people were freaking out this morning because I was really rooting for Dr. Peter McCullough to be the Surgeon General. He's been really doing a lot of great work, and he actually picked someone who has been advocating for the injections offered during the pandemic for pregnant women. That's who he picked. So that's, you know, I don't remember the name. I just saw, that's another thing that I saw just before we hopped on. Some lady who's going to be Surgeon General who said some, you know, pretty not so great things around giving those medications to pregnant women. So that's it's not a good look.
You know that they're now, so I looked this up on the CDC website myself about 6 months ago. How many people under 18 died of, can I name the disease, the illness? Or do we,
yeah,
do we
you
not
can do that. Yeah.
COVID-19. It was like 1,750. If you did the arithmetic, that's about 1 in 100,000 people who were under 18 during this period. Maybe a little off. And then of them, 90% were obese. So if you're a non-obese under 18 person, your chances of 1 in 1,000,000 of dying. Are you telling me that to avoid that, we're going to be giving you a medication that scrambles your DNA that's essentially untested, no long-term results? And I think there's very clear signals in the data that says it creates all kinds of problems. It doesn't create any, there's scarcely any benefit to talk about. There's a huge amount of problems, you know, cancers and turbo cancers and heart and fertility issues. And so to avoid a 1 in 1,000,000 chance, and now the guidance is to give, by the time a baby is 9, to give them 3 such rounds of medication. I've been, unfortunately, around a lot of medical decision-making in my life. I've had all these medical things in my life. And I know how doctors normally think. And it's like, you know, it's about first do no harm, and it's about cost-benefit. It's generally quite conservative. That's not medical people making those decisions. That's money or that's politics. Something else is driving that, because that's not good medical decision-making. And it's, I know that for a fact. So that's nuts. And if somebody, I hope it's somebody who supports that stuff.
That's what I saw.
Well, he has trouble admitting he was wrong, and he was wrong because he got lied to, and he's got to just own that. He was wrong about that stuff because he got lied to, and that's what he should say. He can't double down on that. That's horrific.
Yeah, I know you mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned today, regulatory capture. A lot of these MDs seem to have been under ideological capture, and the only ones still defending those medications are the ones who said from the very beginning, this is the best thing in the world. And I think they don't want to admit that they were wrong either. But I have just
RFK says 50% of a pediatrician's revenue comes from administering certain medications. 50%. People don't, you ever seen that chart of how big the bonuses people were getting out of the government for, if you had 70% of your patients in your practice to take that shot, you got, you know, and these bonuses, quarterly bonuses, and six digit quarterly bonuses. So people were making $300,000-$400,000 extra per year to make sure at least 70% of the people in their practice took the shot. That's not, you know, and I think the doctors who did that are violated the Nuremberg Code.
Yeah, that's actually one thing I discussed with Dr. Peter McCullough, who was on the show twice. And for anyone who doesn't believe what you just said, I think it's Anthem Insurance. You can actually go on Google, type in PDF, Anthem Insurance, that medication we're talking about, incentives. And you'll find it right there. It lays it out in detail, all the incentives offered to doctors for administering these injections. So it's pretty disgusting, really. But going back...
I love it. Good for you to have him on your show.
He's the man. He's such a good guy, and I would have loved to see him as Surgeon General. But going back to the movie, what can people expect when they tune in?
Well, there's just enough of my autobiography. What I learned was, if I try to tell the story from 2015 forward, people just give me the confused puppy look. So there's enough of my life that explains how I got into this, how I got dragged into it. But I got dragged into what became it's really told in 4 chapters, what became the Russian collusion hoax, what became the Clinton investigation, what nobody knew who was working with me in government was that I'd been sent to investigate them by the 2006 Senate Judiciary Committee. And there was this very strange period in my life where the Senate Judiciary Committee, who was aware of my other relationships across government, tapped me on the shoulder and pulled me in and made me, the only time I've been a spy is when I spied for them against the government. and they have the mandate to investigate corruption. And so they had me dealing with different parts of Uncle Sam's nooks and corners and reporting back to them, trying to find the corruption. And they eventually tasked me this very strange meeting where they told me, this is how, what you're going to do with the rest of your life, Patrick. You're going to find there's some kind of corrupt force taking over the United States government. It's our job to stop it, but we can't stop it. But you're going to stop it for us. And here's this letter they wrote me that says, they said this is going to be sitting in a safe the rest of your life in Washington, D.C. And the letter says, basically, I can't be prosecuted. And they said, this is not a pardon. You can't go kill anyone. But short of that, this is going to keep any prosecutor from touching you. Now, this is how you're going to spend your life, Patrick, and we need you to do this. And it's funny, no one was asking me anything. They were telling me to do that. So when I got misused in 2015, 2016, and both to create a fake, the whole Russian thing was fake. Secondly, to set up Hillary Clinton, set up Hillary Clinton for a bribe, because I thought that, and by the way, I was Hillary's biggest donor in Utah in 2004. It's not like a personal vendetta I had against Hillary. I received orders from Barack Obama to do this. From James Comey and Barack Obama. So I did it. And it turned out to be so she could be blackmailed. And then unbeknownst to them, I was actually investigating them. So it's just basically what you can expect is, and then I decided to pull a little fast one on my chain of command and make them do something that would flush them out. And it's going to shock people. I won't even mention here, but it's going to shock people. I basically told my handlers that I drugged a girl in order to question her. And that's kind of a heavy thing to say in the United States. But John Brennan and James Comey let that slide. So then I said, I let them know the next time that I had drugged her and got her inebriated in order to question her. And then while she was knocked out anyway, I had sex with her.
For the record, you did or you didn't do those things for real?
I did not do those things for
real.
Okay,
I just wanted to, yeah.
In fact, in that period of the time, this is the famous Russian spy, Maria Butina, we had two affairs, so to speak, twice. And the first time was very physical. The second time I told her, I deliberately set this up. And I told her, you're going to sleep. I needed her to have a perfectly clear memory that we had never, in that second period, I didn't lay a finger on her. And so I told her we were going to do this old-fashioned courtship and she's going to sleep in the guest room. I just reported this crazy stuff up my chain of command. And I put them in the position of having to sign off on it. And then eventually I offered to murder her. And I knew that was going to go to the deep state. And there was no way this was going to be let slide, that I was going to the deep state and someone was going to have to make a decision, either stop this domestic soft coup we were engaged in, or someone powerful was going to have to put their signature on some horrible stuff for this to continue. So basically it was a sting. The FBI taught me how to create a sting on Hillary Clinton and all the legal theory around it. So I just applied it to my own chain of command and it worked. It worked. And that's so it was kind of, the movie is kind of a mixture of the movie The Sting, the movie 3 Days of the Condor, and Michael Clayton all mixed into one. That's what the movie is. And it's this story or a sting within a sting within a sting. It's kind of, but Michael Flynn did a wonderful job with the director Matt Thayer on constructing it so it could be followed, I think.
It is a really cool movie. And again, I encourage people to see it. What advice would you have to someone who's considering exposing government corruption?
Well, be aware it may cost you everything, but there's nothing. Get yourself as bulletproof as you can beforehand because they're going to come after you. Secondly, just be aware it may cost you everything. You really have to know that you're not going to be treated. One way to say it is, and I learned this when I first fought Wall Street, I thought the world worked like the Pelican Brief, that, you know, Julia Roberts figures out what some evil corporation is doing and she writes up a term paper and she submits it and the DOJ swoops in and the Washington Post swoop in. And, oh, they all want to just, that's not how the world works. When you come across corruption, there's people benefiting from that corruption. There's a lot of people benefiting. And when you go to challenge it and expose it, those people come out of the woodwork and try to destroy you. So that's what you have to be prepared for. So to me, it was, I don't have a family. I don't have a kid. This country's been better than any merit would have actually called for. So it seemed like the least I could do.
Well, we appreciate it. I did save the weirdest question for last, and I hope this isn't too weird, but I'm fascinated by propaganda and influence. It's actually what I talk about probably the most. We even talked about it a little bit earlier. There is this online movement that I see as a deliberate campaign to sort of weaponize the people in a sense. And actually, even Elon Musk has been making posts on this movement recently. So I'm wondering what thoughts you might have on Q. Have you heard of this?
Oh, I know. I've heard of Q. Hard to say. I know that sometimes it's fun to wind up. What has Elon been saying about Q? Do you mind me asking you that first?
So within this Q community, they use certain language, like they misspell the word friends and they spell it F-R-E-N-S. I mean, he shared images with the letter Q in it. He seems to frequently post in ways that correlate with some of what these Q people refer to often, these Q posts. And, you know, those people, they think that Q or that Elon is part of this movement. I mean, you know, being skeptical, it could also be that he's kind of playing with people because anybody can go look on this website and start putting out messages that seem to correlate. So I don't know what to make of it. And you're a very smart dude who, you know, you have a lot of, you know, knowledge on these sorts of things. So I was wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, it's funny. I didn't know F-R-E-N-S was a reference to Q. I know that it's fun to like tweak journalists and for example, the letter 17 or the number 17 is also a big deal. I mean, it's a Q is a 17th letter. So sometimes for fun with journalists, if they tell me, you know, well, how long is it going to take for something to happen? I'll say, oh, I don't know, couple of weeks, maybe about 17 days, something like that, just to watch the steam come out of their ears. Are you acute? You know, so it's fun to tweak journalists and tweak people. It may be that Elon's doing that. It's also could be the case that Q started off as one thing and became something else. Q may have been taken over by, it could be the case. So yes, Q makes these things called Q drops, which are cryptic little predictions. I don't quite know where you find them, or I've seen half a dozen quoted, and they seem to be amorphous, vague predictions that lots of things that could happen would make people say later, oh, you see, this was all, it's all a plan. Some of them are eerily, some of them were eerily spot on. I haven't even looked at any of this in 4 years. And I understand it started again more recently, that like a year or two ago, Q started posting again, maybe. So it could be that Q started off one thing and then it was taken over by somebody else. And another thing it could be is when the Bolsheviks took over Russia, there were the people who fought the Bolsheviks were called the White Russians, and they fought the Bolsheviks and they resisted the revolution. And a rumor got around of something called the Trust. And the Trust was this group of anti-Bolsheviks, expatriates somewhere, and they were organizing an army to come back and fight against the Bolsheviks. And so everyone was told, just trust the plan, just keep your head down for now, just trust the plan. And the Trust is out there building the counterattack. Well, it turns out that whole thing was just another information operation from Lenin and Stalin. And it kept the people who should have been fighting back, it kept them quiet and kept their head down. And it gave the Bolsheviks time to go and mop up their opposition one at a time because nobody was fighting back. Well, people were fighting back, but not like they would have fought back if they knew what was in store for them. So it could be that that's what Q was. And if for it to do that, it had to have enough truth in it that then when they also said, because I know some things they say are crazy false. Some things they say that Donald Trump has really been in charge secretly for the last 4 years, and this was all a plan to draw his enemies out and stuff. None of that's true. None of that, I promise you, that's not true. So, but there was a lot of truth mixed in with the Q drops. And I saw some that looked so vague and they would cover anything that happened, but there were some that were not so vague. They were quite specific, and it was clear in retrospect what someone was referring to. So it's certainly got some truth in it. It probably has some falsehood, and it may be the case that it was started off by Patriots and got taken over by other people, or the whole thing could have been an information operation from the left to begin with, from who, not even the left, the Uniparty, who was planning this overthrow of our republic. Now you know everything I know.
Yeah, I think it's clear. There's no doubt that it's some kind of information operation. And the question, and you brought up some of these questions, is what is the purpose? I almost think the posts themselves are irrelevant. It's like, what's the result of this thing? And it could be, like you're saying, with this Bolshevik movement, maybe it's to pacify the people, or, you know, more optimistically from the Q perspective, maybe it's to weaponize the people in a way that gets them viciously sharing what they believe to be the truth. Because, you know, a lot of these Q people are just savagely posting things all the time on current news and events and trying to spread things that, you know, otherwise might not have been spread. So it's hard to dissect what is really going on.
Oh, absolutely. It certainly got a lot, millions, tens of millions of people to pay attention and drill in and try to figure things out. And if that really came at us from the Bolsheviks who tried to overthrow us, it was a mistake in that sense, because if it woke a lot of people up and got people trying to put two and two together. So who knows? We'll probably find out someday in about 17 weeks or so.
Love it. Well, I'm going to wind down now, but I guess, is there anything else that we should discuss that we haven't?
Michael, great interview. Nice, good of you to have me on. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Patrick Byrne, where can people find out more about you and your work and the movie?
The movie, patrickbyrnemovie.com or enemywithindocuseries.com. If you want to follow me, you follow me on Twitter, Patrick Byrne, or at Locals, which is Patrick Locals, Patrick Byrne. If you want to help me, go to America Project and sign up to be a $5 a month sponsor, $10 a month sponsor. We get several tens of thousands of people to do that, and we'll keep it. I set up America Project to be expeditionary. It was for this four-year period, but it had an enormous effect in the last 4 years. Some historian, when the smoke clears, the dust settles, and the historians write the books, they're going to understand how it was the force behind a lot of things that the springing up of this movement happening so quickly in the first 6 months of 2021. America Project was a very significant part of that, and Michael Flynn. And if you wanted to continue, if we get 10 or 20,000 people who go in and sign up for $5 a month, we'll just have it continue. Its focus is probably going to turn towards Wall Street and fixing Wall Street. So,
well, I am going to put all those links in the show notes. And for the movie, coupon code VERA, which is my last name, V-E-R-A. So check that out. And again, Patrick Byrne, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. It's been an honor to speak with you.
All anytime, Michael. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought, or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.